This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of diabetic Charcot neuropathy from the foot and ankle section on orthobullets.com. Diabetic Charcot neuropathy is a chronic and progressive joint disease following loss of protective sensation that leads to destruction of joints and surrounding bony structures. Diabetic Charcot neuropathy may lead to amputation if left untreated. As far as the epidemiology, 0.1 to 1.4% of patients with diabetes have diabetic Charcot neuropathy, and about 7.5% of patients with diabetes and neuropathy have diabetic Charcot neuropathy. As far as demographics, in patients with type 1 diabetes, diabetic Charcot neuropathy typically presents in the fifth decade of life, that is typically 20 to 25 years following diagnosis. In patients with type 2 diabetes, diabetic Charcot neuropathy typically presents in the sixth decade of life, that is typically 5 to 10 years following diagnosis. As far as the location for diabetic Charcot neuropathy, the foot and ankle is common. 9 to 35% of patients have bilateral disease. Other locations include the shoulder and elbow, as well as the knee, which often leads to ligamentous instability and bone loss. Risk factors for diabetic Charcot neuropathy include diabetic neuropathy, alcoholism, leprosy, myelomeningocele, Tabes dorsalis / syphilis, and syringomyelia. As far as the mechanism and pathophysiology of diabetic Charcot neuropathy, there are two main theories: the neurotraumatic theory and the neurovascular theory. The neurotraumatic theory is that insensate joints are subjected to repetitive microtrauma and the body is unable to adopt protective mechanisms to compensate for microtrauma due to abnormal sensation. And the neurovascular theory is that autonomic dysfunction increases blood flow through arteriovenous shunting, which leads to bone resorption and weakening. As far as the molecular biology of diabetic Charcot neuropathy, inflammatory cytokines may cause destruction. Specifically, IL-1 and TNF-alpha lead to increased production of transcription factor kappa-beta and the RANK-RANKL-OPG triad pathway. Associated conditions with diabetic Charcot neuropathy are foot ulcerations, which is a whole nother topic that we'll discuss in more detail in another episode. As far as the classification of diabetic Charcot neuropathy, there are two main ones to know: the Brodsky classification and the Eichenholz classification. The Brodsky classification has five types. Type 1 involves the tarsometatarsal and navicular-cuneiform joints, and collapse leads to a fixed rocker bottom foot with valgus angulation. And 60% of diabetic Charcot neuropathy patients fall into this type. Type 2 involves the subtalar, talonavicular, or calcaneocuboid joints. It is characterized as unstable and requires long periods of immobilization, sometimes up to 2 years. And approximately 10% of diabetic Charcot neuropathy patients fall into this type. Type 3 is divided into two subtypes, type 3A and type 3B. Type 3A involves the tibio-talar joint. Late varus or valgus deformity produces ulceration and osteomyelitis of the malleoli in 20% of patients. And type 3B follows fracture of the calcaneal tuberosity. And late deformity results in distal foot changes or proximal migration of the tuberosity, and this is seen in less than 10% of diabetic Charcot neuropathy patients. Type 4 involves a combination of areas and accounts for less than 10% of patients with diabetic Charcot neuropathy. And finally, type 5 occurs solely within the forefoot, and this also accounts for less than 10% of patients with diabetic Charcot neuropathy. Moving on to the Eichenholz classification, this is divided into four stages. Stage 0 is characterized by joint edema, radiographs are negative, and keep in mind that a bone scan may be positive in all of the stages. Stage 1 is characterized by fragmentation, joint edema, and radiographs show osseous fragmentation with joint dislocation. Stage 2 is characterized by coalescence, decreased local edema, and radiographs will show coalescence of fragments and absorption of fine bone debris. And finally, stage 3 is the reconstruction phase, which has no local edema, and radiographs show consolidation and remodeling of the fracture fragments. As far as the presentation of diabetic Charcot neuropathy, symptoms may include a swollen foot and ankle, loss of function, pain in 50% of patients, and no pain in 50% of patients. Physical exam for acute Charcot neuropathy should include inspection, where you will likely see swelling, warmth, And in fact, the limb is an average of 3.3 degrees Celsius warmer than the contralateral side. You may also see erythema, which is often confused with infection. And erythema will decrease with elevation in Charcot arthropathy, but is unchanged in infection. That's important, so I'll say it again. Erythema will decrease with elevation in Charcot arthropathy, but is unchanged in infection. Chronic Charcot neuropathy on inspection will reveal a structurally deformed foot, bony prominences, a rocker bottom deformity, and collapse of the medial arch. As far as motion in diabetic Charcot neuropathy, patients may be ligamentously unstable, and neurovascular status should be evaluated using SEMS-Weinstein monofilament testing. With respect to imaging, obtain a standard AP and lateral of the foot, as well as a complete ankle series. And as far as findings, early changes will show degenerative changes that may mimic osteoarthritis. Late changes may show obliteration of the joint space, fragmentation of both articular surfaces of a joint leading to subluxation or dislocation, scattered, quote, chunks of bone in fibrous tissue, surrounding soft tissue edema, joint distension by fluid, and/or heterotopic ossification. Bone scan may be useful to help determine the presence of superimposed osteomyelitis. As far as the type of study, a technetium bone scan may be positive for a neuropathic joint and osteomyelitis, while an indium white blood cell scan will be negative or cold for neuropathic joints and positive or hot for osteomyelitis. MRI is the best test for differentiating abscess from soft tissue swelling. This is the most sensitive test in diagnosing soft tissue and/or osteomyelitis. However, the limitation is that it's often difficult to differentiate infection from Charcot arthropathy on MRI. Laboratory studies to get include inflammatory markers like an ESR and white blood cell count, which will both be elevated in both infection and Charcot arthropathy. As far as wound healing levels, an absolute lymphocyte count of greater than 1,500 per cubic millimeter and a serum albumin greater than 3 grams per deciliter are markers of adequate wound healing capability. Biopsy may be used to guide antibiotic therapy in cases of diabetic Charcot neuropathy-associated osteomyelitis or soft tissue abscess. Histology in these patients may show synovial hypertrophy and/or detritic synovitis, which is basically cartilage and bone distributed in the synovium. Treatment for diabetic Charcot neuropathy can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management involves total contact casting, shoe wear modifications, and medications. This is typically the first line of treatment. With contact casting, casts are changed every 2 to 4 weeks for 2 to 4 months. As far as orthotics, a Charcot restraint orthotic walker or a crow boot can be used after contact casting. As far as shoe modifications, an Eichenholz Stage 3 double rocker shoe modifications will best reduce risk for ulceration at the plantar apex of the deformity. Some medications that can be used in diabetic Charcot neuropathy include bisphosphonates, neuropathic pain medications, antidepressants, and topical anesthetics. As far as outcomes of non-operative management, there is a 75% success rate. Operative management has a few options, including resection of bony prominences, aka an exostectomy, as well as talo-Achilles lengthening. Other options include deformity correction, arthrodesis, plus or minus osteotomies, and amputation is also an option. We'll go into the indications for each of these options now. Resection of bony prominences, aka an exostectomy and talo-Achilles lengthening, is indicated for a, quote, braceable foot with Aquinas deformity and focal bony prominences causing skin breakdown. The goal with this procedure is to achieve a plantigrade foot that allows ambulation without skin compromise. Deformity correction, arthrodesis, plus or minus osteotomies is indicated for a severe deformity that is not braceable, and as far as fixation techniques for an arthrodesis, this can be either internal fixation or external fixation. Internal fixation can involve screws, pins, plates, and/or a tibiocalcaneal nail. External fixation is used when bone quality is poor or the soft tissues are compromised. Postoperative care in these patients involves minimal weight bearing for 3 months. The cons of an arthrodesis is that they are actually associated with a high complication rate of up to 70%, in fact. And these complications specifically include infection, hardware malposition, recurrent ulceration, and fracture. Finally, the last resorts are amputations, which are indicated after a failed previous surgery like an unstable arthrodesis and/or recurrent infection. The goal of an amputation in these patients is for a partial or limited amputation if vascularity allows. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. The first question reads, a 63-year-old man has long-standing type 2 diabetes. He has had associated ongoing neuropathy for approximately 5 years. He now reports a red, hot, swollen right foot for the past 2 days. You place him supine in your office with the foot elevated for 30 minutes. You return to see that the redness has dissipated. What is the most likely diagnosis? And the choices are 1. Cellulitis, 2. Osteomyelitis, 3. Charcot arthropathy, 4. Sjogren syndrome, and 5. Raynaud syndrome. So Charcot arthropathy is a progressive condition of the musculoskeletal system that is characterized by joint dislocations, pathologic fractures, and debilitating deformities. This disorder results in progressive destruction of bone and soft tissues at weight-bearing joints. In its most severe form, it may cause significant disruption of the bony architecture. In patients with diabetes, the incidence of acute Charcot arthropathy of the foot and ankle ranges from 0.15% to 2.5%. Acute Charcot arthropathy almost always appears with signs of inflammation. Profound unilateral swelling, an increase in local skin temperature, generally an increase of 3 degrees to 7 degrees above the non-affected foot's skin temperature, erythema, joint effusion, and bone resorption in an insensate foot are present. These characteristics in the presence of intact skin and a loss of protective sensation are often pathognomonic of acute Charcot arthropathy. Cellulitis is an infection of the skin, and osteomyelitis is an infection of the bone. Examination of the limb would remain unchanged after 30 minutes of elevation. Raynaud and Sjogren syndromes are rheumatologic conditions that do not have these symptoms. So the correct answer to this question is 3, Charcot arthropathy. Moving on to the next question. A patient with diabetic peripheral neuropathy undergoes a partial first-ray amputation for a chronic ulcer beneath the first metatarsal head. The insertion of the anterior tibialis is preserved. The patient has 10 degrees of passive dorsiflexion at the ankle and no other foot deformities or ulcers. Which of the following is considered appropriate shoe wear for this patient? And the choices are 1. Snug-fitting shoe to block side-to-side motion that is common after this procedure. 2. A leather sole shoe to prevent catching the shoe on carpet, which is common with crepe-soled shoes. 3. Lateral wedge on the shoe to offset the external rotation during the toe-off phase of gait, commonly seen after this procedure. 4. Steel shank to extend the foot lever and prevent deformity at the toe break. And 5. Custom-made shoe to provide the best possible fit and function. So the steel shank is a flat 1-inch steel strip placed between layers of the shoe to extend the foot lever and prevent deformity at the toe break seen following a partial first-ray amputation. A rocker sole may be added as well to facilitate transition from the foot flat to the toe-off phase of gait. Proper shoe fit is important, but snug-fitting shoes in a patient with peripheral neuropathy and likely fluctuations in volume from intermittent swelling are to be avoided. A custom shoe is an unnecessary expense. The patient has at least 10 degrees of dorsiflexion at the ankle with an intact anterior tibialis muscle. Therefore, catching the sole on carpeting should not be a problem. But the correct answer to this question is 4, steel shank to extend the foot lever and prevent deformity at the toe break. And the final question, a 54-year-old diabetic man complains of swelling and erythema throughout the midfoot for 2 weeks. He denies any known trauma. The midfoot is warm, red, and swollen with no skin disruptions on physical exam. The erythema diminishes with elevation of the foot for 15 minutes. He has a temperature of 100.3 degrees Fahrenheit. The patient's CRP is 2.6 with a normal range of less than 6.0. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? And the choices are 1, navicular stress fracture, 2, neuropathic arthropathy, 3, osteomyelitis, 4, embolic ischemia, and 5, rheumatoid arthritis. So the clinical description is most consistent with neuropathic arthropathy or Charcot arthropathy of the midfoot. Dissipation of erythema with elevation is the key finding differentiating neuropathic arthropathy from infection. A foot with osteomyelitis or a deep abscess will remain erythematous with elevation. Vandervan et al. Provide a summary of the clinical presentation, evaluation, and treatment of Charcot arthropathy. Prevention of deformity remains the hallmark goal of treatment. That's all for this review about diabetic Charcot neuropathy. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.